the pundits promise, with weird relish, that we are seeing the end of sleep as we know it. TV has become a glum hall of prophets. Dr. Devisha Frank from the Boston Sleep Tank, who speaks like a robot programmed to self-destruct. Dour professors wearing sunflower yellow ties that film well. According to these professional Cassandras, sleep has been chased off the globe by our 24-hour news cycle, our polluted skies and crops and waterways, the bald eyeballs of our glowing devices. We Americans are sitting in an electric chair that we engineered. What becomes of our circadian rhythms, the old glad harmonies that leapt through us like the vascular thrust of water through leaves of grass? Bummer news, Walt. That song's done. And the endogenous clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, hereditary prize of every human, that tiny star cluster of neurons in the hypothalamus, which regulates our yawning appetites for hard winter light and spacey blackness, the master clock that syncs us to one another and to the Earth's rotation, the sun and the moon, to all the sister kingdoms on the 24-hour circuit, bacteria, Gila monsters, great sequoias, blue whales, orange groves, bear cubs, mustangs, toadstools, leopards, golden ingles, hyacinths, hippopotami, those tiny wizards, the butterflies, those glue artists, the arachnids, and all the sequin life on the seafloor, the black urchins that improbably still clock time with us. Bummer news, everybody. The clock stops for humanity. Time itself will soon become an anachronism. Time, as our species has lived it on the planet, will cease to exist. No more dark light binary. No more active red daytime, blue evening dissolving. No longer is sunshine the coagulant of consciousness, causing us to clot into personalities, to cohere once more on our pillows each morning. These TV scientists predict a global desertification of dreams. Soon, they promise, the disruption will afflict all of us. Sleep will go extinct. And eventually, unless we can find some way to synthesize it, so will we.
Wow.
It's kind of grim. Sorry, guys.
That is a very grim beginning to a story. What a setting.
That's a heavy one. Should I read that little bit about the animals again? For some reason, I was like, damn, I sure listed a lot of animals. I ran out of breath.
No, I liked it. It was perfect. It was perfect. Anyway, Karen, given the subject matter of this new novella, I have to wonder about the inspiration. Do you suffer from insomnia?
I do, but I it's funny, and I can't even lay claim to that anymore. Having done some research for this novella, I realized that I'm mildly sleep deprived compared to some genuine sufferers of chronic insomnia. I have kind of bizarre sleep patterns. Everybody in our family seems to.
Really?
But nothing.
How bizarre? What are your sleep patterns?
So my brother actually really legitimately suffers from night terrors, which has always been frightening to watch as a sibling, you know. I was thinking just about that helplessness, you know, when I was writing this novella, just how untranslatable a nightmare is, you know, the way it kind of disintegrates when you're trying to articulate it and how nobody can really help you mm-hmm. when you're locked into that kind of terror and pain or really how speech isn't even really much of a solace because you can't translate what's so scary about the dream. You know, it just never sounds that scary out loud. So my brother has these terrible nightmares. We get competitive about it. I'll say I have a bad nightmare and he swears to me, you know, it's his best dream. And then everybody, I don't know, I'm always awake at 4 a.m. I just don't sleep through the night. So there'll be this strange window where I'm just kind of not doing anything productive. I mean, it's funny. I was reading about Benjamin Franklin, who also would wake up at 4 a.m. but then, you know, discover electricity or map out a city or write a book. I'm just kind of eating an apple waiting for dawn.
Maybe this is the secret to your genius.
Oh, and I'll ratify that. I'll sign off on that. But I think it's funny that it's such a strange time to be up, you know, when everyone else is asleep. It really is such a bizarre space. And I think everybody knows it intimately. I mean, everybody that I've talked to about sleep deprivation, you know, has a story about a period of their life where they couldn't sleep, they had trouble sleeping.
Do you like it, that being awake at 4 in the morning? Because I confess that occasionally I can't sleep and I like it.
Sometimes. It depends on what's coming, and it depends on how, if I get on the hamster wheel of anxiety, you know, and just become really anxious that I, you know, how that kind of feeds perversely into your inability to sleep, then it's not so fun. But if it's, sometimes it's wonderful. Sometimes it's a special privacy when all the other consciousness is blinked off and you're by yourself.
Well, so let's talk about this world you've created in sleep donation. This is set in the near future in the midst of a lethal insomnia epidemic. What's going on as you imagine it?
So we're 7 years into this insomnia epidemic, and they've invented a new technology, pretty recent technology, sleep donation. I think the closest analogy I have to something in our America, not this imaginary one, would be sort of the American Red Cross, you know, or blood donation. So if you sign up for this program, a white van comes to your house at night and they slip a, you know, catch mask, the silver helmet on you, and you breathe into a tube, you take an ultra sedative, you're rolled under into sleep, and you donate your dreams to an insomniac. And that's sort of the umbilicus that's attaching all of these insomniacs to life. I mean, they can no longer sleep on their own, so they're wholly dependent on these sleep donors.
So what's happened that there's this insomnia epidemic? I mean, have you worked out a kind of plausible medical scenario for this?
I hope so. I mean, I think that some of the underpinnings for it actually are plausible. I have some good neuroscientist friends, and we sort of had fun, dark fun, you know, but drafting out a kind of orexin dysfunction, a dysfunction to the system that regulates arousal and sleep-wake cycle, appetite. And narcoleptics, they have just the opposite problem, right, where they have just a totally interrupted wake cycle. Thanks, Anne. And in this world, I was thinking the dysfunction, no one knows what triggered it, if the cue is environmental, you know, if it has something to do, as in the section I just read, you know, there are all kinds of paranoid speculation that we've absolutely altered some animal rhythm with the way that we're living today, you know, that it's connected to our glowing devices or maybe to some kind of, you know, underlying genetic cause that's been active. No one knows, right, what the trigger is. Except that it does seem like this growing population is suffering this orexin dysfunction, and they can't sleep, and if they can't sleep, they die.
Wow. What's the disease progression? I mean, have you worked that out, too? I mean, maybe this is getting too ghoulish. But...
No. I think it was funny in a story that also is tonally sort of trying to signal that it's in an imaginary America and, you know... riffing on some dystopian literature, but also I wanted to take really seriously the consequences of something like this. There's the closest analogy I think we have is something called fatal familial insomnia, and this is a prion disease. It's really upsetting to read about, really incredibly sad. And after the onset of total sleep loss, sufferers, they die of cardiac arrest or they die of multiple organ failure. It's difficult to really, I think I mentioned this in the novella. I mean, it's funny, people will claim that they are suffering from total sleep loss when in fact they're underreporting the amount of sleep that they're getting, or they're experiencing something called microsleep. So if you're extremely sleep deprived, you'll say that you're awake and parts of your brain, certain neuronal networks are going offline. So it's sort of these cortical round robin of rolling blackouts, if that makes sense, you know, and so you're unaware actually of kind of how much sleep you may be getting. But once with these people, it's a genetic, they have this genetic condition and it sets in middle age, the fatal familial insomnia, and then it's really a question of months, you know, usually, and it's terminal. So I thought that was so frightening. And I think also just... to me, what seemed frightening also was unremitting wakefulness, you know, without access to dreams or, the restorative function of sleep, but especially dreams somehow. That struck me as a real horror story.
Well, all of which brings us to your protagonist, Trish Edgewater. Her sister was one of the first to die in the insomnia epidemic, and So Trish now works for this emergency organization, yeah, kind of like the Red Cross, called the Slumber Corps. what can you tell us about Trish?
Sure. So she, you know, things really didn't take off for me until that lady showed up. She's the first, I think, in my short story collection, there's an adult female protagonist, but I've never tried anything this length, and I was excited to have a first-person narrator who is, you know, this young adult woman. I sort of gravitate towards wall-eyed 13-year-old boys or monsters, so this was exciting for me. And she's in her late 20s, and she lost her sister to this fatal insomnia. You know, her sister had had trouble sleeping her whole life, and then for unclear reasons, when she was in her 20s as a college student, this dysfunction kicked in and eventually killed her. They didn't have the sleep donation technology at that time. So I was imagining someone who's in some ways quite naive, right? She really wants to give her life unreservedly to a cause, and this seems to be the right one, where she's going to solicit sleep donors for this program. You know, they have all these insomniacs on their wait rolls, and they need healthy sleepers. They need good dreamers to provide rest for these people. And what she does is she has this sort of dark talent, I guess, for grotesquely kind of recreating her sister's death and implanting this nightmare in some ways in these potential donors. So her recruitment strategy, I was thinking, is pretty, speaking of ghoulish, would be pretty ghoulish. And she feels increasingly ambivalent about the way she's going about asking for these sleep donations as the novella progresses.
Mm-hmm. Well, to get a sense of how you imagine sleep donation actually working, there's a section I was going to ask if you'd read.
It's
near the beginning when Trish is describing what she does as a volunteer for the Sleep Corps. And this is on my book, it's says page 9. The paragraph begins as a Corps volunteer.
Oh, you got it. Okay,
and
so
then
here
if
we
you
go.
Could just take it down to, if your sleep was disturbed by her face, check the box. End of the page.
Sure thing.
Okay.
As a Corps volunteer, my duties are numerous and varied. Weekends, I mobilize the sleep van, a moonlit enterprise that dispatches a volunteer team to the homes of good sleepers who have signed up to donate their rest to insomniacs. A sleep van has a Spartan interior. The beds we call catch cots. If the van is equipped for infants and children, it features catch cribs and trundles. Nurses slip on the anesthetic mask, open the IV of special chemicals, relieving a donor of consciousness. Next, they clamp on and adjust the silver helmet, which does chafe a bit. 1 to 2 minutes after the loss of consciousness, once the donor enters a state of artificially stimulated sleep, the draw commences. The air in the sleep van turns balmy as the tubing heats. A donor's dream-moist breath gets siphoned into nozzles that connect to our tanks. Healthy sleep is pumped out of the body into long, clear tubes. Weeknights, I recruit. We set up for sleep drives in neighborhoods all across the country right at sundown. Nurses swab out helmets in multiple vans, preparing to take sleep donations for testing. Administrators sit inside lit tents on suburban lawns, holding clipboards, pre-screening donors with an eligibility questionnaire to filter out those whose sleep is prone to nightmares, disturbance. We babble questions to volunteers under the midnight pines. When was your last full night of deep, unbroken sleep, ma'am? When did you last dream about barking dogs, outer space, red grass, an ex-wife? Now please be honest, sir. If your sleep was disturbed by her face, check the box.
It's both so improbable and so incredibly realistic.
That's bureaucracy for you, right? It's just sort of like, well, how are we going to compress a lot of horror into a questionnaire? You know?
Right, right. So different and yet still the same.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that happens, right? It is sort of that same action of kind of translating something wordless and unspeakable and painful, and then you're like, here's your form. Let us know your medical history. Like, how did your grandma go? You know, that kind of stuff.
Well, there's a particular donor or donor family that Trish works with, Mr. and Mrs. Harkonnen?
I called them Harkonnen, but I'll sign off on anything.
Okay. Mr. and Mrs. Harkonnen and their daughter, Baby A, and she's something kind of special. She's a universal donor.
Yeah, she's a universal donor. I mean, you know, it's funny, when I was first sort of sketching out this place, that was a throwaway detail that my unconscious just threw out like a frisbee. I don't know, that babies would be donors in this kind of a scenario, that the Supreme Court would rule that babies can be donors. And I was just thinking, maybe, you know, with some kind of Swiftian relish or something, that is likely the best source of, you know, uncorrupted sleep.
Just but this sleep is, that, it's such a creepy twist. I mean,
I hope it's creepy, huh? I was thinking too, just the, yeah, a sleeping baby is sort of emblematic of all kinds of innocence. And
well, and this baby is only 6 months old. The first time someone takes her sleep, what's it called? Draining her or drawing it or something?
A draw on a catch, yeah, on the little sleep trundle. I mean, I suppose if I had to do some kind of post hoc confabulation, it does seem like in a crisis, the costs are always borne, right, by the weakest and the most vulnerable, you know, that there is this way in an emergency situation where certain nuanced looks at who is going to support the costs, or those, all of that gets suspended, I guess. And I was thinking about that time of suspension, how dangerous it can be, where the need becomes so great that people stop asking certain questions. And I think that, you know, it just made sense to me that in this particular para-reality, it would be these babies that they were draining for sleep. And
well, one of the things I like, though, is that, yeah, you've set up this horrific thing, but in fact, they are having the moral debate there inside your story also. I mean, the father of baby A isn't so sure he wants his baby donating sleep anymore.
Yeah, I think that this is sort of the scale is a little gonzo, right, to have this set against a backdrop of a global insomnia epidemic. But those questions feel pretty close to home, you know, to the home that we're living in here. And I think what we owe one another, the context in which a gift like that is made, the troubling aspect of a gift like that, right? I was thinking, you know, the obvious analogs, I guess, would be blood and organ donation. But you have a gift that's really, they call it the gift of life for a reason, right? I mean, it's an inherently unequal position between donor and donee. Mm-hmm. And I think that can create all kinds of moral complexity. And I think for this father, what part of the horror story there for me was that these are very good people, the Harkonnens, you know, they do feel an obligation, this moral obligation to donate sleep to help, you know, and with sort of this emergency situation. And they have, the father anyway, has sort of less and less confidence that this institution has any sense of him as a human man or his daughter as a human daughter any longer, right, as this flesh and blood daughter, that she's sort of become this larger than life, you know, baby, a universal donor. I should mention that they just discovered that her sleep is of a purity that it can be transfused into any body. So her dreams and her sleep have, they you know, it's usually a difficult process to match a sleep donor to an insomniac, and not so with this little kid.
Wow, you've really worked out all the details.
Yeah, it's silly, right? I just love
what
I love.
No, it's fun. It sounds like I could just imagine you sitting with friends, you know, kind of like almost like a board game, you know, night after night after night, working out the details.
I think for me, for it to feel like a real world with consequences, right? You know, for those questions to have any kind of weight at all, even in a world that is sort of Midsummer's Night Eve bizarre, you know, it's just sort of Midsummer's Night Eve in Pennsylvania, or occurring in an octave shift, you know, its own sort of place. That's the kind of dork that I am, Anne. I really want those questions to carry some weight. So then I did have to sort of think about the underpinnings of this place.
Yeah. Well, we keep getting all these little side glimpses also of kind of tantalizing places that we don't even really get to explore, but must have been so much fun to make up. The night world, for instance.
Oh, I loved writing that section. That was so fun for me.
Which is
scary, too.
What kind of a drugstore bar?
So the night world, I imagine, is these kind of tent communities. If you're up all night anyway and all day and don't have anywhere to go, I just thought there would be some sort of you know, these gypsy communities at the edges of towns that are sort of tolerated by the authorities, because what are we going to do with all of these zombied people who can't sleep anymore? And I think that they sort of operate this, like, this black market, you know, where these predatory merchants come and just, you know, when you're desperate for anything, for sleep or just any kind of relief, I think you're a lot more open to kind of quack remedies, you know? Like if Western medicine has failed you, suddenly you're like, yeah, crystals might be my medicine. Like, let's mail me something from the Tucson airport. Maybe, you know, there's... And I was just thinking about, anyway, you know, that actually, to be serious for a second, is how pain makes you so credulous. And
right.
So I imagine,
there's a whole
enclaves where they gather at night, and maybe there'd be bars where they're drinking medicinal cocktails, trying to get to sleep together.
Well, and then there are more elite kind of places like the poppy fields.
Yeah, I loved, that's just an image that I loved as a kid from The Wizard of Oz, you know, where this tremendous lion falls asleep in the poppy fields.
Right, they're running from the witch and through a field of enchanted poppies, and they all fall asleep.
Yeah, so I was just thinking, you know, maybe just another... I almost thought that the real appeal of a place like that is that it's sort of a lighthouse beam for other sufferers. So if they're traveling to these night worlds, it's just because the relief, the solace you can find, if you can't find a cure or if you're on the wait list for one of these transfusions or whatever, I just imagine would be the company of people who really in a physical way understand what you're undergoing, you know, the hell of that. But the poppy fields, I imagined, is just sort of, sure, these gardeners kind of keep these poppy fields going at the edge of the city. You can pay a staggering sum of money, and ostensibly there's going to be an olfactory perfume puts you under, you know, from these flowers.
And you can even rent sheets and a pillow.
Rent some sheets and a pillow. I mean, it sounds so goofy, and it is a little goofy, but I think that there is something serious and frightening about being at a frontier where all the other remedies and options have failed you and what you're willing to try, you know? And just that there are, you know, there really are these sort of, we know them from our world, right? People who will take advantage of the suffering in a state like that. You know?
So, Karen, I just heard about another new piece of fiction about sleep. It's a novel called Black Moon by Kenneth Calhoun.
Oh, I've heard about this, yeah.
Yeah. So, and in this one, his protagonist is one of the last people who's still able to sleep, and he has to deal with a world of insane insomniacs. So I don't know if this is just, you know, coincidence, synchronicity, or...
Isn't that wild? I sort of love it. I mean, I think I haven't read his book yet. I'm dying to. I think there is something. So I was really curious about the way that dreams might migrate, you know, from mind to mind here.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of this nightmare that goes viral, essentially, right, in this world. And I just think that... that kind of communication, the way certain winds blow through people and manifest as dream or idea, it's really interesting. And it's not surprising to me, and somehow really exciting that this, the author of Black Moon, we're all coming out of a period where people are sort of obsessed with sleep and wake states, I think. And the zombie has had this resurgence, and I think that's interesting, right?
Our producer, Doug Gordon, was just showing me an article about a guy, this is real, in the real world, not in a fictional world. There's a guy, an inventor named Hunter Lee Soik, who's created a new app called Shadow. And what he wants to do with it is create a huge dream database in order to discover connections between our sleeping and our waking selves.
And can I tell you something wild? So when we were working on this, it's just a little throwaway bit, and it's not what it was in the original draft, which was that I had the CDC, you know, and these other new agencies were tracking dreams, right? They have dream epidemiologists because they want to see if there are these potentially infectious nightmares. They're doing dream donations, and some nightmares are infectious. That's what they're filtering and, you know, screening the sleep for. So I had this idea that there would be like a CDC database, the same way they keep databases for other, you know, contagious diseases and alerts and updates, you know, sort of like the gazelle dream runs rampant in eastern Ohio, you know, or just they would be able to track the patterns of dreams the way you track weather patterns. And
but
it's
I think
happening.
That's what this guy really wants
that's
to do.
That's what he's doing. That's what I'm saying.
Isn't
that crazy, though? I mean, I just thought... Well, what, you know, it's tough. You can't even keep ahead of
right.
What's actually happening.
Art imitating life or life imitating art.
It's a funny thing. Know, which... And it makes sense to me, too, somehow that people would be, I wonder if Kenneth touches on this, too, but just a preoccupation with how much data, how much of our subjective experience we make available, too. I mean, I think, you know, this woman who has such a real ambivalence by the end of the novella about the work that she's doing, sort of coercing people to make these donations. I do think that's a funny thing, that sleep is sort of the last bastion where you have a total privacy from, you know, advertisers or from these other four. You know, I just think it'll be interesting to see who signs up for that app.
Well, I don't know. I think it sounds interesting.
Me too.
So do you think do you worry that our own sleep, our own circadian rhythms are endangered, not as extremely as in your fiction, but are endangered by the kind of always on culture we've created?
You know, I guess I just personally, I'm actually not a huge internet person. I don't Twitter, and I think that I don't really check in. With Facebook and social media and things like that, in part because what drew me to books and writing is just that the quiet, you know, you get a real deep, still quiet outside of the onslaught of experience. So I feel lucky because I have that refuge, right, like of books and writing. I wonder what the future holds. I do think that, you know, I don't think, I didn't mean for this to read as a, you know, some sort of explicit critique of the way that we're living now. And I don't think that, you know, our iPhones are going to cause some, worldwide insomnia epidemic or anything. But I do wonder if there'll be some pendulum swing in the other direction at a certain point where people really crave, you know, the solitude of something like reading a book. You know, we'll see. I hope so. That's my utopian vision of how this thing might go.
Mm. But what do you think is going on that there's all the, I mean, the synchronicity we've been talking about, a couple of different novels and an app all about sleep.
All about sleep. I think people are really aware. There is probably an animal panic about the vertigo, because things are changing so rapidly. I think in some ways this was written out of that disorientation, you know, that dislocation where I do feel like the old day-night binary is dissolving in some ways, and that there is a pressure now to be, you know, the ubiquity of your presence online somehow, and also that it's anonymous. That's sort of disorienting, the way people expect you to write back to an email. You know, Google will tell you did you reply in 0 minutes or 1 minute? You know, like,
great.
I think that people are probably responding to that and pushing back on that just a bit. Because it is a funny way to tithe most of your daylight to these machines, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to your strange avatar that you maintain online. I wonder how that's going to play out in the years to come. You know, what the breakdown of how we spend our time on the planet is. It's really difficult, I think. I find it difficult to be away from the phone and the computer now. I don't know if you have that.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I crave getting
away
from
it. I think that's right. I think that's what it is. I think it's people recognizing some animal hunger to be offline without the paranoia that the giant compound Argus eye of the internet we made is not observing us, you know, without the parent, you know, this sort of strange way that we have to feed our selfies, I guess, or to this creation. I was thinking about how dated 1984 would feel to teenagers today in some ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we just did it ourselves. We just made this giant Oculus ourselves and volitionally, you know, feed our data and our lives to it. It's a funny thing.
So going back to sleep, I'm curious, did writing Sleep Donation change the way you either think about sleep or change the way you sleep for a while?
It did. You know, it's funny. I mean, I think for me, in a metaphoric way, I was thinking about sleep and unconsciousness, the pull of that kind of oblivion, as related to kind of coming awake to your own motivations and staying awake. Does that make sense? Like, so it was less, in a way, it was less for me ultimately about, you know, physiological sleeping and waking than sort of how difficult it is to be honest and to maintain that kind of vigilant state. How difficult and sort of, you know, and then impossible in some realms, right? Like, I think there's, you couldn't find the optician that would give you the full panorama of your own motives. But sort of, you know, avoiding the temptation towards amnesia and oblivion and just willful denial and trying to stay awake and oriented in a good direction. But then in terms of my own, I guess, just biological sleep, it's still the same. I still wake up at 4 a.m., you know, I still kind of stare at the ceiling. And I think I prioritize sleep now in a way that I didn't, because I learned all of this stuff about how sleep is correlated with, you know, well-being and happiness and health. And my big takeaway, I talked to a neuroscientist who said, you know, I asked him if it, you know, he was making a case that sleep is the ultimate thing you can do for your body and your mental well-being. So I got permission to sometimes sleep in instead of jogging. So that was one fun takeaway.
Well, I was going to say, thanks for writing a book that'll keep us all awake at night.
No, I'm telling you guys, sleep in on a Sunday, better than jogging. Just give yourself that hour.
Okay. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Anne.
Well, it's always fun talking with you.
I had a great time. I had a really great time. Thanks. I'll send you guys some dreams if they ever invent this technology. I'll select the good ones.
Your dreams will be worth more than other people's.